important questions that can be asked about the miracle stories, and it's not my intention to silence any of them at all. It may be that you've got something that you've been wondering about for some time in respect to a given story or some other story. If you have, by the way, suggestions as to what material you'd like to see considered, mention it to me afterwards. Similarly about the format, if you feel like you'd like to have me talk more or less, whatever, I would really appreciate hearing from you, because it takes a little while. I'm just acclimating to the village myself, and it takes a little while to get at this. But among the variety of questions that are just almost knee-jerk responses for us with respect to these stories are such things that arise really from our worldview. And by the very fact that we generally categorize these stories as miracle stories sets them in a certain frame. Because I think for most of us, when we use the word miracle, we are operating with a sort of natural and supernatural dichotomy. We think in terms of miracles as something that are supernatural, as outside of what is possible or natural within the realm of nature, and God is somehow intervening. Now that concept of natural law, or the way in which God manages and administers the universe through process of natural law, is a bit unusual or foreign from the point of view of the scriptures. There's much more of a concept of God's presence in everything. Dramatic, dynamic, active in throughout the whole order of the world. There isn't really a concept at which I think most of us have inherited, whether we know it or not, from the kind of general Greek worldview of an established order which is run by principles and laws and concepts and ideation. And instead of that, it's the concept is really one of God's presence everywhere. So we have to, if we can kind of step back from these stories, first of all, and say, well, let's put at least a parenthesis around that word miracle, because that may bring in some baggage that's a bit unnecessary. It may be necessary for us to come back and ask that and say, well, now, within the realm of nature or the laws of nature, which at least for centuries we thought were pretty well boxed in, is such a thing possible? Now, you all probably heard the story about the kid who went to Sunday school and came home, and his father asked him, well, what did you hear today? Well, it was a story about Moses crossing the Red Sea. Oh, he says, well, tell me about it. Well, the kid sat there for a minute. He says, it's kind of like this. Moses and all the people were coming up against the Red Sea, and the Egyptians were hot in pursuit. And Moses didn't know quite what to do, so he got on the walkie-talkies and he called in for the amphibious force. And they came across to the boats, and they got just inside the boats, and then he had to call in the phantom jets to strafe the Egyptians, and they got across just in the nick of time. And his father says, now, come on, that isn't the way you heard the story. And he says, no, but you never would believe what they told me. And there is obviously something unbelievable about all these stories. And I think if we try to rationalize them and make them believable, we spoil it. Now, whether we do that from a nature supernatural concept of miracle or not is kind of irrelevant. The same thing is true in the ancient world. The whole concept of a wonder or a epiphany, a divine manifestation, a revelation, is that it can't be explained. There are people shaking their heads and scratching their tunics at the same time here too, trying to figure out what this is about. How can this be? This is a marvel, a wonder. I never heard of a thing like this. So to kind of let that sense of wonder or awe or the inexplicable stand a bit, we're almost driven to try to explain it somehow. The late 19th century, there's some great scholarship done on these miracle stories by people who were very confident that the world was intact and run by laws. I think there are lots of things, even in terms of our whole understanding of physics, that have changed, that have reawakened a sense of wonder or awe at the way things work or operate in the world. Maybe it's more possible for us to allow a miracle or a wonder or an unexplained phenomenon to stand than it was in the late 19th century. But there are some grand ones there about how, in fact, the story we're going to consider today of the miraculous catch of fish is explained by one interpreter as a Jesus that had just come over the hill. And of course, you look down on the Sea of Galilee from there, and he could see where the school of fish was. And so as soon as he was done talking, he got them in the boat, and they went out and they dropped their net in that place. And there was really nothing miraculous about it, you know. You can walk on water if you know where the stones are. You know, the kind of explanation, rationalization of the miracle stories, which I think completely blows it. That arises from our need to try to explain it. The texts themselves stand in such a fashion as to say, this is something that we just can't explain. We can't account for. It is a mystery, a wonder, a marvel. Now, there may be some of these stories which we would have different explanations for if we had witnessed them. We would interpret the raw event differently, given a certain kind of worldview that we have in contrast to theirs. I think we have to allow for that, and it's very interesting to go back and sometimes and ask, what kind of thing lay behind this, and if we had been there, would we have interpreted it in the same fashion, or is our world different? There certainly are differences in worldview between the first and the 20th century, but they're the kind of events that call for some kind of interpretation. What does this mean? What is this about? I was sitting in my study one day, and I had the radio on, and the door opened because it was time for student conferences or something, and one of my colleagues walked down the hall and said, well, I can see that you don't believe in the miracle stories. And I said, what in the world are you talking about? He says, well, you know, Bultmann said that anybody who has once listened to the radio can no longer believe in the miracle stories. And there is something of that terrific gap between the ancient world and the modern world. But on the other hand, let's not overstate it. They looked at these things as well and said, this is really weird. This is strange. This is bizarre. And it calls for some kind of interpretation, some kind of explanation. So I guess I'm going to suggest that we can come back, and if you have many of these questions about what really happened, or could that have happened, or did it really happen that way, are interesting and can be asked, and we may want to discuss them. But I won't be spending my time primarily beginning with those questions. If you want to bring them back in, that's fine. Instead, the kind of question that I'd like to see us consider is, what do these things mean? What are they about? And we'll be looking in the story. Some of these are repeated in more than one gospel, not the one that we'll begin with today, but several of the others that we hope to get to will be. But I'd like to consider them primarily within the context of one gospel, which is the Gospel of Luke. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that I fuss with the Gospel of Luke more than the others. I feel more comfortable working out of that. But also, this is the year of Luke and your churches, and so many of these texts you will have heard in this version either sometime during the year, or they may be coming up yet during the year. And I'd like to suggest that what we're going to be about here is to view the gospel as an interpretation. That take the word seriously, that this person who wrote it, whether it was Luke the physician or someone else, we really can't settle that question. I don't think there's much payoff in that, by the way, to start beginning and say this is some of the scientific training and who is trying to explain those, because even if this was the physician who accompanied Paul, and it's very difficult to establish that one way or the other, but even if it was, his training as a physician is so different from anything that we would see in the 20th century that I think we're very likely to introduce anachronisms that way. But whoever this person was, he was an evangelist. That's the way the early church described what these books are. They are gospels. They are attempts to interpret what this was about, who Jesus was and is, and what it all means. So somehow, and we have a variety of ways of reconstructing how the stories got down to the evangelists, what they looked like when this evangelist inherited them. But this evangelist is repeating or rehearsing a story that's probably familiar to the most of the people in the Christian community. They've already, in the case of Luke, it's probably already been written, and many of these miracles have already been written down in Mark's gospel. So he's repeating or rehearsing them, in a sense, preaching a sermon on the tradition, on the stories as he's heard them. And his sermon now is in literary form, set in context, in which we hear the story, in this case, the miraculous catch of fish, after Jesus has been in Nazareth, and after casting out of a demon, and so forth. And we try to ask ourselves, what has he done with that? In the process of retelling it, what has he suggested that it really was about? And what is it? What did it intend to mean by it? How did he interpret this phenomenon, this strange event? And then, of course, we want to get back and ask the other question of, so what? What does that mean to us? What does that offer us? What value could that have, or what light does that shed upon our experience, our understanding of the way in which God relates to the world and the meaning of Jesus? So let's look at a story now. Well, first of all, any questions about that kind of procedurally or comments? We've got plenty of opportunity here. Okay, let's look at Luke 5, 1 to 11. Now, really, we should ask you to sit down and read Luke 1 through 4. Everybody got a look at a text, by the way? And I'll be reading from the Revised Standard Version, but it's kind of interesting sometimes to compare translations. I have the Greek text here if we need to check something. This isn't a hard text to translate, though, so it shouldn't be a problem for us anyplace. Okay. Something about context, first of all, leading up to this story. Because I'm going to start off by asking something of what we think Luke is doing with it. So since we don't have time to sit and read through the first four chapters, let me just rehearse them for you a bit. They are structured differently from the other Gospels, which is one of the things that's most interesting and fascinating about the study of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or the so-called synoptic gospels, is that they arrange these stories in different sequence to try to establish exactly when Jesus did a given thing and what order is very difficult, probably impossible in any final sense, because the evangelists tell the stories in different sequence. Now, is that just to confuse us? No, you see, one could, the first shock, if you've ever looked at the gospel parallels, by the way, I took this one out of the Holden Library. I might just want to pass this around. This particular text is not paralleled, but I'll set it here if you want to check it afterwards. But that's one way to see that the evangelists, in fact, are working with pieces of tradition and arranging it in some sort of fashion, kind of like a collage or mosaic, so that when you stand back, it says something. So we look at the way in which the pieces are arranged. How do we get from A, B, C, or D to where we are? And in this context, we have a very interesting point, fairly close to the beginning of the gospel, or the beginning of Jesus' ministry at any rate. we have in the opening two chapters the preparation for Jesus' ministry, opening three chapters really, the birth and childhood of John the Baptist and of Jesus, the account of John's preaching, which is really fire and brimstone, especially in Luke's account. Then we have the long genealogy, Jesus' baptism, the long genealogy, identifying who he is with reference all the way back to Adam, not simply back to Abraham, which is the case with Matthew, but we got Adam, the father of all the races, identified as the first son of God up to Jesus, son of God. And then we have the temptation story, and then that incredible encounter in Nazareth, in which Jesus comes and identifies his claim, quotes from Isaiah and says, "This is it. Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." And you have that kind of pregnant moment in which there's a consideration of who is this Jesus. And then they kind of end up attacking him, and he attacks the crowd, and it's a violent interchange leading to an attempt to kill him right there on the spot in chapter 4. So we have Jesus announcing who he is in word, and in the rest of chapter 4, we have, say, in verse 31, 32, he went down to Capernaum, city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath, and they were astonished at his teaching, for his word was with authority. And then we have an exorcism in which he squares off with the powers of Satan, leading up to verse 36, and they were all amazed and said to one another, "What is this word? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and they come out." A kind of word and deed connection. This Jesus is somebody with whom to contend, and something's happening here, but it's all kind of raw and uninterpreted. They can see they're dealing with a force, but who is this? Or who was that masked man kind of question? What's this about? And then we have the account of his healing Simon's mother-in-law, and leading into our chapter with a brief retreat, ending in verse 43, "I must preach the good news of the kingdom of God to the other cities also, for I was sent for this purpose." And he was preaching in the synagogues of Judea. Now we have the introduction to our story. When the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had ceased speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a great shoal of fish, and as their nets were breaking, they beckoned to their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he was astonished, and all that were with him, at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. Henceforth you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. All right, now after that it follows a story of a cleansing of a leper. We have a whole cluster of miracle stories in this chunk of Luke's text, which is really dealing with kind of establishing, both by word and deed, who this Jesus is, setting his credentials out before the people. All right, now, as you look at this story, what do you think it's about? You any clues as to what the evangelist himself wants us to see in the story? Some sense for, or any hunches that you'd like to follow up as to what the evangelist wants to communicate to the reader about what's going on in this story? What do you think yourself? What do you think the story is about?
Preparing the disciples for what was going to happen to them in the future.
Okay, all right. Where do you get that?
At the last part, okay. Where it says, "Henceforth you will be catching men."
Okay. All right, now I think you're going for the throat right off the bat. We could have horsed around with a lot of other things for quite a while. All right, that's good. But it's a kind of a strange story, in a way, to be dealing with. It doesn't fit in some ways, does it, with a discipleship story. Seems kind of like a strange ending But I think you're right that that's really what Luke is doing with it. He is using whatever this event was, this, you know, marvelous account, as a way to zero right in on the question of discipleship. Now, Norman Hobble has written a nice little play about taking off from this story, which I think picks up on your point quite nicely. You know the play in which he's... you consider the end of this story. Here's two boatloads of fishermen just had a super catch, filling the boats to the scuppers, and they come in and they walk away from those boatloads of fish. You know, highly unlikely, and maybe the most miraculous part of the whole story. And he has a little play entitled, "What Are We Going to Do with All These Stinking Fish?" It's kind of a nice little, helps point out the inconsistency of the story, really, which we just pass over quite often. It's really not, he's not dwelling upon the marvel or the miracle of the catch of fish so much, but he wants us somehow to get at the business of discipleship. And what do you think he's saying about it? Anybody? I mean, this stick, yeah.
Somehow these men that were with Jesus, somehow saw the wonder of this man, and he's trying to tell us somehow, maybe even simple, how they saw this wonder and were able to leave everything and follow him.
Right, right. Okay, now, what is it that they've seen?
Well, I was thinking he must have seen something pretty quick, because he's not a fisher man. But if I had been fishing all day and this stranger walks up, had they met him before this year? You know, and they had been working hard the whole time, and some stranger comes along and says, "Go out there, you'll catch a lot." I really, what faith they had to believe a stranger,
yeah.
I would have just shrugged it off and said,
sure.
Sure. You know, they didn't catch a fish. So, they must have seen something right away to really believe him.
Yeah.
To say, "Oh, you say there's fish, we'll go out and try again."
Okay. Now let's go back to that. Let's see. Let's find that connection first of all. There is a little lead-in that he gives us here, and this is probably again one of those places in which we have the story of. And by the way, let me put little parentheses here. The question of did Jesus really do miracles and so forth, or did these all meet up or something? In some sense, I'm dodging that question by dwelling at the level of what did the evangelist make of the story. But I think there is enough evidence across both the New Testament and even the attacks on Jesus' character by, say, in the Talmud, in which he says he was hung as being a magician, indicate that he really had a reputation as a miracle worker. Now, that's not unique in the ancient world, and it's also not unique in the modern world. I mean, there are all sorts of people around, both then and now, who are supposedly have these kinds of powers. And we've all seen things ourselves in which, on television or whatever, in which people seem to have kind of amazing powers at their disposal. Now, is it all, you know, tomfoolery and trickery, or is it real? And what is this about? It calls for interpretation. But there is enough evidence across this thing to suggest that Jesus really had a reputation as one who did these kinds of things. And probably in this case, we have a story about Jesus and the disciples and this terrific catch of fish. But what we're trying to get at now is how did the evangelist work that in or weave it in to his gospel. If we think of it as a collage, he's got a little chunk of tradition, a story about a catch of fish, but he's really making something of it in a way that points toward discipleship that isn't automatically in the story, but he's saying that's really what it was about, that's how it's connected, that's what it means to us in the context of this gospel. It becomes the occasion of faith, which it very well may have been a historical occasion as well. It's not... these things are not impossible, but we can see at least that's what Luke is making of it. Now, similarly here, in terms of the introduction, we have A nice little phrase. Has anybody got a King James text? What are the first words of the text in 5:1?
And it came to pass that as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret.
Okay, now that's a kind of a classic, both Old Testament phrase and particularly Lucan phrase, that, and it came to pass. It's the genito de entis, in that time. It's like a kind of a once upon a time phrase. I don't mean to say that means it didn't happen, but it's a formula to introduce a new transition. It's a literary formula. It happens at the point of the birth of Jesus, the beginning of his ministry, the point at which he turns to go his face to Jerusalem, set his face to go to Jerusalem, and so forth. Luke uses this little formula. And it came to pass that such and such was happening. Right away, that tells us that we have Luke's pen at work, constructing a link, putting this thing in connection with what precedes it, and introducing what's going to follow. And it's also something of certain moment, certain weight involved. And it came to pass. I mean, you know, it does the same thing for us. It's kind of lost in the case of in the Revised Standard Version. You can't do everything in a translation. But they just start off while, and they lose the literary formula. They keep them alive in the King James. That's, you know, I'm not trying to pump for the King James, but I think that in that particular case is a strength. All right, now, so we have Luke leading us into the story, and I'm going to get back to the point that she raised, because he really does want us to see something of why the disciples, or why these fishermen, did such a strange thing as to allow an itinerant preacher to order them to put out their nets. And you even have a bit of account of that the fisherman knows this is kind of nonsense. I mean, you don't fish at this time of the day and all that. You've heard all those things in sermon illustration, I'm sure. All right. But the occasion is Jesus coming down into this the valley of the sea, standing by the lake, being pressed by the crowds. He gets in a boat because of the nearness of the crowd, and they set out and stand off the shore a bit. And it says there that he sits down and taught the people from the boat. Now, Matthew, by the way, doesn't have the same story, but he has a very similar account of Jesus being pressed by the crowds and going out and sitting in the boat. And actually, he says, and he sat down in the sea, obviously in the boat in the sea, and the people stood on the shore. Now, that's just that little vignette gives us a picture of what's going on. It's the rabbi teaching. Now, we have just the reverse. When the pastor gets in the pulpit, he stands and everybody sits, and he preaches. Now, in the synagogue, at least in the ancient synagogue, I don't know, it varies from synagogue to synagogue, but even in a very Orthodox synagogue today, the rabbi will sit and the congregation will stand to hear the teaching that's going on. So Jesus is teaching like he has been doing in the synagogues, but in this case, out there under God's blue sky, teaching like a rabbi, and he is addressed as such, master or sir, dealt with in deference by these fishermen. Now, probably the more unlikely thing is, how did he convince them to sit in it, put their boats off the first 10 feet? After he's once established that, getting out to the middle of the lake maybe is not such a trick. But he walks in, they move out, and he teaches as a rabbi does. Now, I think this is the way in which Luke ties it together with what's preceded. Almost all the thing before focuses upon his teaching, even the miracles. They say, what is this word? Well, Luke really wants us to see that Jesus' word carries clout. And people are kind of astonished, amazed, impressed, also confused. They don't know what to make of this. And the story that we have back in Nazareth is, that which should be instruction to all preachers, ever since, the world's shortest sermon, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing, period. That's the end of the sermon. And they are astonished and amazed and perplexed and eventually angry that someone would make such an audacious claim. So he comes and he presents the word that he represents that he is, but that he communicates, and it becomes the message and the medium are very closely tied together as a claim. Here it is. The immediate question is now to throw the ball in the court of the hearers. What are they going to do? We get a negative, a hostile response in the fourth chapter from his people in his own hometown. But then we also get a kind of a wondering response in these other stories, even the connected with the miracles. What is this about? What do these things mean? And this is the first time we move toward any sort of closure positively. What is this about? What do these things mean? And this is the first time we move toward any sort of closure positively. Now what's going to happen? So he teaches, and they're all kind of, doesn't say that in this case that they were amazed, but he teaches, sat down, taught the people from the boat, and when he had ceased speaking, he said to Simon, be nice to know what he had taught to that point, what he talked about. But Luke condenses everything. I mean, obviously, we also do not have any attempt by these evangelists to be complete. All these stories represent a very condensed version of everything that happened or was remembered to have happened. They are not attempting to tell us everything at all, which also invites us to think, well, now, why did they tell us this? What's this about? What's he after? All right. So then he it's on the basis really of his teaching then that he says to this fisherman, now let's go back out into the lake. And you get that kind of objection. I mean, master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word. And then we get that connection again. What is this word? And at your word, all right, your word seems pretty solid, pretty impressive, if nothing else. If you say so, we'll do it. But it's not just as you say so. I don't know how other translations render it, but the little key one word there is very important. He plugs it in at several points. Jesus' word is terribly impressive. Go back to the Old Testament accounts that precede this, and the word of the prophet is critical. And the word and the connection between word and deed. If one's words correspond to their deeds, there is integrity there. There is something to be trusted. So we have in several stories here, Luke tying them together. Jesus is a mighty prophet in word and deed. He is for real. Yeah. And he's about the business of establishing those credentials. So, at your word, we will do this. All this really is leading up, I think, to the point that you're making about discipleship. All right. And then we get this fantastic catch of fish. And I guess, there are probably lots of things that we can make of that, and maybe questions that you have pondered about the catch of fish itself. What do you suppose the catch of fish represents in some form? Why was this story appropriate for the evangelist to think of as a story of discipleship?
were fishermen, so it was on their level.
Right. Right. A rather direct connection. It does always kind of troubled me, I guess, that they quit being fishermen. I just assumed they would stayed and lived out their ministry as fishermen. But this was a different time and occasion. But it really becomes that of saying we're going to talking in terms of your vocation now is a call to a new vocation. Henceforth, you will be catching men. All right. Other comments or questions about the story itself? Yeah.
Well, it took a leap of faith in the first place for them to do this at all, because it looked pretty ridiculous to do it after they had gotten anything all night.
Right.
And so it is with anything that has to do with our spiritual existence that we take this leap of faith that something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any clues in the story that let you know that somehow they perceive this as a question of spirit or a spiritual issue? This is probably, I think, the real nub of the turning point. Yeah.
Well, I think it's shown in verse 8 where upon contact with this wonder or miracle, Simon Peter all of a sudden becomes conscious of his sin.
Yeah. Again, a non-sequitur. Why? How did that come in there? We're talking about fish. And, you know, a kind of a logical reaction is, wow, we're going to make lots of bucks, you know. But instead the response is, depart from me, O Lord, for I'm a sinful man. You ever think you've heard that phrase before? Remember other stories like that?
After the resurrection. Didn't he?
No,
resurrection in John's Gospel?
Well,
did he say that? He just leaped out of
me. All right, that's the closest story, by the way, in account. We have another fishing story. In a resurrection account in John's Gospel, and it really has puzzled interpreters to wonder if there is the same story at the base of both of them that have been retold differently, or we have two different accounts. Did Jesus, in effect, recall his disciples, which is the way in which John is telling the story? But that's another kind of issue. The Old Testament, we've got a whole bunch of stories.
Isaiah,
the call of Isaiah. Is a classic in which we have the sense of impurity at the point at which God manifests himself. This text is used in the Epiphany season of the church year, which I think is an excellent selection. It really is an Epiphany story, a divine manifestation in which God has somehow appeared or revealed himself. And those are the kind of stories in which you get this kind of classic response. Somehow, in the midst of all these fishnets and slime and fish and whatever, it's the what this fisherman sees is a divine manifestation. And the sense of the idea of the holy or the numinous, the overwhelming presence of God himself, which both has promise of life but also the threat of destruction in it. For anyone who is unworthy to stand in the presence. Now, the Isaiah text says, woe is me, you know, kind of sense. We also have the appearance of the angel to Samson's parents, a kind of a classic text in the book of Judges, in which they say, depart from me, go away, because we're sinful. And this sense of the impurity in the presence of the purity of the divine may destroy us. If I am cleansed by this purity, there will be nothing left of me. You know, it comes up in a whole the story of Moses. It's not exactly the same phrase. It is the same phrase in the text from Judges, and there's another text of the call of Gideon, also in Judges. Exactly the same phrase. Go away. As soon as the person appreciates the fact that it's the divine presence that is confronting him, it's scary stuff, you know, and we really are frightened that it may in fact destroy us. Somehow Peter sees that here, and I think if one were to try to say what's really the miracle or the marvel in the story, it's that for Luke. how in the world did he know what really had happened? Somehow this Peter, as representative of the disciples and the faithful believers, recognizes divine presence in this astonishing event. Other people had said, wow, you know, to exorcism stories, what was that? The demons had said, we know who you are, and so forth, but still the people said, you know, what was that about? They don't trust the word of a demon or a possessed person to really identify who Jesus is. And we've had stories in which Jesus has manifested himself in his preaching, and people have said, well, that's who you claim to be, but we're not having any. You know, we don't accept that. So it's really a story of the miracle of faith. How is it that somehow the Spirit of God breaks through to us? And when that happens, the awareness of our own sinful condition, our need for grace, our dependence upon divine presence, and is evoked. That's a miracle. It really becomes an epiphany story, a kind of a classic text to talk about God is present with you, both in the sense of claim and of grace. And that's, I think, the primary miracle with which Luke sees in the story. All right, other comments here? Yeah.
Faith in David when he committed the sin of taking Bathsheba, and right. Then he becomes, after Nathan, you know, points up to his
right.
Sin to him, and he becomes very contrite and realizes and has a change of heart completely.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't quite the same, but.
No, but you're right. They're kind of the Psalms of Lament, in particular, which are expand upon that whole story of David and Nathan and Bathsheba at great length, dwell upon this just again and again, that the sense of our impurity or David's, in this case, he becomes a kind of a classic example, and obviously some of those psalms are really written in his name on the behalf of other penitents over the years. But, you know, woe is me, for I am undone. Is a powerful theme. And somehow, but you know, when you think of all that packed in these short 11 verses, where we get a kind of a narrative connection with what's preceded, the sense of word, at your word we will do this, connected with what's preceded, it's a very artful story, well told, and the kind of non-sequiturs, the things that really don't fit, the rough edges are the places in which we kind of say, now he's doing something with that there. All of a sudden, the story of a miraculous catch of fish becomes an epiphany and becomes a call to discipleship, the occasion in which this is a classic text for, even ordination texts and whatever are frequently drawn from here. All right, other comments?
Also, it points out the futility of their human efforts in catching the fish and the great results of the word of the Lord. And I would think that would be a good lesson for new disciples also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. When you say the futility of it, the master we toil all night and took nothing kind of emphasis, huh?
Sort of giving up itself, which we have to do.
Yeah. That will come up in that. If we go out, just flick quickly over to say about the 10th chapter. I had not thought of that one before in that connection. But another. Another connection like that. Out in the 10th chapter, we have the account in which the disciples themselves, in this case, we have in the 9th chapter the sending of the 12, as you know, and the 10th chapter the sending of the 70. And two very, you know, this probably represents really the mission to Israel and the mission to the world in those numbers. At any rate, that's in Hebrew tradition, the 12 of the 12 tribes and the 70 for the 70 nations. Just cycles again and again, particularly in intertestamental literature. But in this case, the 70 go out, and out in verse 17, a kind of an interesting story which may reaffirm what you're saying. The 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Behold, I have given you authority to tread upon serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. There's a certain kind of chain of command sort of thing that's implied here, in which they really are going to be endowed, the church is going to be endowed with powers, have resources at its control, but not to be manipulated for self-aggrandizement, but to be in the service of that kingdom. That's really what it's about. I don't, you know, one of the things that's difficult here, too, is how much humble pie does this gospel want us to eat? There is in a text like this one, a critical sense of awareness of one's own sinfulness and, I suppose, even inadequacy. I don't know if that applies to the fishing directly or not. But there's, throughout the Gospel of Luke, a very strong note, Luke and Acts, strong note of encouragement for the disciples, probably stronger than, say, we get in Pauline tradition or even the Gospel of Mark, in which, in the Gospel of Mark, the disciples always look a little bit dense, almost overdrawn, to the point that every time Jesus is talking about that he's going to go to Jerusalem to suffer and die, they're sitting in the background saying, now which of us is going to get the good seat in the kingdom, you know? Three times in a row, on the way they're discussing something, and then the mother comes and says, will you take care of my sons and give them the good places? And they're just completely out of it. So dense that they become a real parable of the problem of people trying to make something of it for themselves. Luke softens that quite often and really emphasizes that Jesus has endowed the church and his disciples with powers and abilities. This is a gifted community. They've got something to work with. You've got a job to do and so forth. So it may be there's some tension here as to how much we should emphasize the kind of negative, you know, like you can't even fish unless I help you kind of thing. If this were Mark, I'd really stress that. In this case, there surely is something here that no matter what you do with the blessing of the Lord, it's going to be bountiful and abundant and increased so much the more. Whether it's as negative as it would be, say, in Mark, we might have to look at that one more extensively. But it's an interesting comment. Others? Yeah?
Oh, I see Jesus approaching Peter here in a very, you know, Peter is a very practical man, and he has to be shown.
Uh-huh.
And so he is demonstrating what's going to happen if we are responsible or obedient.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also on the account of Peter's denial.
Right.
And Christ told him he was going to do, but
yeah.
It wasn't until it actually happened that then Peter became very contrite.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, but the thing that's interesting here, I think that's right. The whole, by the time we know how the story comes out, it really becomes that sort of demonstration of where the power is and how it really works. But Peter sees through it before it all has been, before we've gotten to the punchline of you shall be disciples or be fishers of men. We haven't gotten to that yet. So there is a sense of, and that isn't really his practicality that's been discussed yet. He doesn't respond as a practical man and say, wow, look at all the fish we've caught. He rather responds as a believer and says, depart from me. You know, he knows what really has gone on. I think it's true that we have, if we started at the end and said, that Peter knew at the beginning that what Jesus was doing was making a play to get him to be a disciple, then it would be kind of a show me. The story of, we got those kind of stories in the Bible, clearly. I mean, the story of the fleece and the call of Gideon, right. Thank you. in which he says, prove it. You know, I need to know something. I need to have some kind of demonstration. But that all is taking place, in a sense, the following after Jesus just kind of happened. My reason for saying that and emphasizing that, coming back, is that the miracle of faith is the thing that he addresses, not so much that this is a proof over against the community that you know can look at this thing and see that Jesus really could do it. How did the question is, how did Peter see through it in such a fashion that he understood what was going on? Lots of people have seen phenomena like this, and people can also stand back and see them today and say, yeah, but what does that prove? What does that mean? Suppose one, this is, could easily have been open to the interpretation that Jesus saw the fish from the top of the hill, like they said in the 19th century. Or, wow, that was lucky, or isn't that super? We should keep this guy with us every time we go fishing. But it's instead a response of a different order that I think breaks through. You want to pursue that, Father?
No, the thought occurred to me that we don't know what Christ was talking about. The message from the host. I was thinking, well, maybe Peter still had some reservations.
Okay. All right. Now, maybe so. Yeah. Now, see, that's the kind of question which we're trying to ask, what really happened there in the event itself. And it's very difficult to avoid that we really are tempted to speculate because we'd like to fill in those gaps. Maybe that's right. Maybe Jesus had made an appeal for followers and Peter was still sitting there a little cool and saying, well, you know. And so Jesus says, all right, let's go fishing. And then he says, wow, okay, let's go. I'll follow you wherever you want to go. But we don't have that first thing in there. We have no, and for some, Luke doesn't really want us to, doesn't draw the picture that way. Which makes the response all the more amazing. What is it that Peter has seen? How did he catch on?
Well, the fact that it happened to him on his level. Uh-huh. It was his first experience, the aha experience, when each of us come to that realization, hey, this is for real.
Yeah.
And it happened on his level, which happened to be fishing.
Right.
And
right.
He saw a miracle in his life in his own area.
Right. Right.
Rather than some far off miracle that he made or performed in someone else's life or that reached
right.
someone else where they were.
It's pretty clear it was addressed to him as a fisherman. That's right.
It seems to me that Peter responded the way Paul exhorts us to respond all through the whole New Testament later on.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Jesus put it to one fellow who said, he said, follow me. And the guy says, well, let me go bury my father. And he said, you know, let the dead bury the dead. It's a total commitment thing for Peter.
Yeah.
And his partners.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They tied up their boats and they let him go. And, you know, the fish rot or somebody else took him probably.
Right.
And it's just, it's not a hot or cold thing like they, or a lukewarm thing like they talk about in Revelation. It's all out.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that gets me at the question that we're a little coming out of time here, but I think we must spend a little time asking, and I think maybe that's the way to pursue it, a kind of a so what? You know, what are we going to do with this story now? How does that thing touch us? I mean, we're not fishermen. In a sense, it isn't addressed to us.
Well, isn't this one of the first confrontations that we have with Peter?
Yes.
And the kind of person he was? And it's like all of us needed Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the kind of person that he was and all these confrontations mm-hmm. that he had mm-hmm. with Jesus, with his faith, with his own doubts, all the rest of that, and how that meant through all of these things, through the denial and everything,
mm-hmm.
remained on top. He came out on top.
Yeah. Peter, throughout the Gospels, is really the representative of the church. And there are good reasons why the Roman Catholic tradition tries to talk about Peter as the first pope and so forth. He really is kind of the representative of the disciples, to such an extent that in this case it's, you know, it's all about Peter, and then it says, and all were astonished, and also were James and John. And I mean, you kind of, he gets those in, because that was surely part of the tradition. But he really focuses the story on one person, which is a way also, a very important storytelling technique, so that we all feel very individually involved. It's a story about one of us, you know.
Peter was the owner of the boat, however, it states that in
right?
the living. You know, he was the owner of the boat, so he had full command of the other men. They were working for him.
Uh-huh.
He was the one, so even in our authority
right.
structure, they would have obeyed.
Right, but he maybe didn't own the other boat that came up. That's true. It does emphasize that he got into Peter's boat. Now, it's also interesting, though. Let's go back just a little shot further, back to verse 38 in the previous chapter. He rose and left the synagogue and entered Simon's house. Now Simon's mother-in-law was ill with a high fever and besought him for her, and he stood over her and rebuked the fever and left her, and immediately she rose and served them. But nothing is done with that story. Now, these stories don't all occur in the same sequence, and it's almost as though that should have happened later. We really would think that this encounter with Simon Peter would have come first, and then we have this other story. But as Luke tells the story, this event doesn't occasion his becoming a disciple. Maybe that's why he allowed him on the boat. I don't know. I mean, it's not tightly locked together logically at that point. But it's kind of tantalizing to have that little story hung out there in front. And it's interesting, each of the Gospels uses that story about Simon's mother-in-law slightly differently. It means a slightly different thing. We won't get into all that now.
Why does Luke write in the first place? Isn't he trying now to preserve the church? Isn't he saying, he isn't coming right away?
Okay.
And doesn't that enter in then to the way we look at the story when he talks about in that word?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No.
That I raised the question.
No, no. Well, we will come to that eventually. One form or another, it always comes back. What's this written about? What's the purpose of the whole gospel? Because if you don't have some sense of the intention of the whole piece, you can't really deal with a small part of it. I don't know if you've seen or heard Rich Kemmerer's tape about the ceiling over there. It's a marvelous tape. And at the end, he's just discussing technique and so forth, and he says, and by the way, someone asked me, and I was all done after having spent days upon days painting that ceiling, why I did it. And he said, up to that point, everyone asked, what does this mean? What does that mean? And he says, but when someone asks you why you did it, he says, that's a question of another order, or something like that. And he says, it kind of stops you for a minute. And he says, the only reason I can think of for doing it is I hope to make God laugh. That's a marvelous remark. Anyway, I don't think it's quite the same for Luke, but we can see something of the intention of address to the church, yes. I think we'll have to talk about that one a bit tomorrow. I'm not as happy. I think it's clear that the situation has changed from Mark's time. The incredible intensity of Mark's gospel, Jesus doing everything immediately, immediately, immediately. You have a sense that bang, 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 bang. The time is marching on. The time is short. Luke has much more of a sense of expanse, and I like to talk about it as the gospel for the duration, whatever time there is. But whether I don't particularly like the notion of, I don't think it works to say it's a delay of the parousia motif, that he is really apologizing for the fact that the end hasn't come or something. He really is addressing a church and saying, in the time in which you've been given, this is what it's about. And surely this story is intended for a church, a model story of discipleship, in which the aha moment, as you say, for each of us, when it breaks in upon us, it is a claim. Not just for then, but for life. And it really means that this master, this Lord, is the manifestation of God himself, and all of life is changed from that point on. It's a conversion story of sorts as well, but not one that emphasizes the kind of pointedness of it, but one that draws our attention to the opening to a whole future. We'll come back and we'll talk about that a bit more. Better take coffee. My cup's empty.
That's very interesting. Thank you.